I think that's historically true. And, of course, it tends to be hemisphere-based, you know, if you look at colonial history and so forth, and even the way colonial history has translated itself into contemporary social realities in Africa, well, or the Americas as well. You don't have to look too far. There you can talk about indigenous languages, for example, which Worf would have said they were equally as rich as any of the Indo-European language tree. So there's a sort of imperialism which reflects itself in language and culture. In other words, when the French went to Africa, what did they bring? They brought the church. So their schools were pretty much missionaries who were teaching French and the culture of la mère patrie, the mother country, France, to people in Mali and Senegal and so forth.
It wasn't just the French. I mean, the Belgian did that too. The Germans did that as well. The English did that as well. The Portuguese, yeah.
Absolutely. And there was no monopoly on this kind of cultural imperialism, but the language went with it. And now, you know, what is the national language of Senegal? Well, it's French, but there are probably dozens of indigenous languages still spoken, and some in a significant way, like Wolof and so forth, so that the uses to which language is put, in other words, there's the language of diplomacy, which used to be French. Now English is pretty much the language of everything, commerce, diplomacy, and the list goes on. Of course, when I first went over to Portugal, I went as a professional basketball player. Within 6 weeks, I had to give practices in Portuguese. That was not easy. I went back 20 years later, the small town where I first played and where, as I've mentioned, there were no English speakers. And I was invited to a game and then invited to go in and give a little talk to the team. So I walked into the locker room and started addressing them in Portuguese. And then I realized that other than two guys down at the end of the bench, no one knew what I was talking about. The coach was an Anglophone. All of the players, there were three Americans, two Lithuanians, a Spaniard, a Serb, and two Portuguese. Their entire universe was in English. This was in a small town in Portugal. And I said, oh, and spoke to them in English, you know.
It's interesting because, to your question, these power dynamics exist also within individual languages because of cultural imperialism and linguistic imperialism, which I'm so, you've elucidated so well, Chris. But, you know, I think about how when I was learning Spanish, I was learning Spanish in high school in South Texas, and I was taught Mexican Spanish as the default pronunciation and vocabulary words of choice. And it was not until many years later in college and in graduate school that I was really truly exposed to Spain-based Spanish and to Catalan and to other dialects of Spanish and became aware of the biases and the condescension and the tension between the languages that reflect this colonizer dynamic that I was very unaware of as a 13 and 14-year-old learning the language for the first time. But the same is even true, you know, we can think about just the geographic span between Mexico and Spain is vast. But those same dynamics might occur in modern Italian, where you have dialects in Rome that are different from the dialects in Naples, that are different from the dialects of Sicily. And generally speaking, the further south you get in Italy, the more derided by the northerners your dialect of Italian is likely to be. And this also reflects cultural power dynamics, because the closer you were to Milan, to Venice, to Rome, the more likely you were to have powerful connections as far back as the Crusades.
Don't we have that in America with the different accents and the dialects of English spoken here?
We do, but I would say I'm not sure it's as bad as in the UK, though, where you have the public school accent, meaning the private exclusive for the aristocracy and their descendants, and then working class, you know, East London accents and so forth. That's quite extreme differences. Of course, in French, you know, you've got Le Parisien and everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, the French Revolution intent was a leveler. They wanted everyone to speak and write the same way. Well, people don't evolve that way. And, of course, they sent a bunch of people over to Quebec, then essentially cut them off without a dime for a century or so. So they evolved. And now when the Quebecers go back to France, they get insulted by, c'est pas du français, ça. It's not, that's not French. Mm-hmm. In spite of the fact they are native speakers of French and have a really unique and beautiful, albeit very distinct way of expressing themselves.
Get the sense in America that the versions of English that are spoken in the African American and the immigrant American community are the ones that are really looked down on.
Yep. And in any lower economic bracket, for that matter, too. You point to the South, but it's, you know, there are class-based accents in the South. There are the Southern Belle versus the non-Southern Belle Southern accents, right? Or you might think, we're in Pittsburgh, we might think of the Appalachian accent as a good parallel, where the Appalachian accent is distinct from, say, what you encounter in urban cities of the same space, same geographic space. It is interesting, though. I know, I reset us to the year 100, but the prioritizing and the politicizing of one's primary language, of the language of the colonizer, it's not inevitable. There's this broader attitude, especially in those early centuries of contact between the Roman Empire as a colonizing power, and Greece, the mainland, and the extended Hellenic world, or the Oikoumene, as it was regularly called after the conquest of Alexander. Because when Alexander takes over the eastern half of the Mediterranean, he basically installs laissez-faire government systems. So in Persia, he says, you have satrapies, they can stay, but I want all of the decrees in Greek. And so you see the development of Koine Greek, which is common Greek. That's all that Koine means. When the Romans, specifically Julius Caesar, follow in the footsteps of Alexander and they take over the Oikoumene, where Koine Greek is already practiced as the default legal language, the Romans say, well, we can understand Greek, so this can stay as it is. So it's only in occasional spaces for specific legal purposes that you see Latin as the de facto legal language. So, for example, in Egypt, you see Latin being prioritized for divorce cases. But Egypt is an interesting space because most legal codes during the Roman Empire are left in Greek, but all tax codes are still in native Egyptian, because Alexander was too busy taking over the rest of the Eastern Mediterranean to rewrite the tax codes. But you end up with this Roman Empire that is a Latin-speaking population for its rulership, at least for the first 300 years or so, who are perfectly content to let the eastern half of the Mediterranean continue to use Greek.
That sounds like a different story than what Christopher was talking about when European countries colonized Africa or North America or South America.
Yeah, I guess you could say it's different. I'm not sure about the economic reality of, but I'm assuming that those conquerors also had in mind lucre, right? Mm-hmm. Just like the colonial system was a system of exchange of raw materials for manufactured materials to the benefit of the mother country. Once they got through all looking for gold and stuff with the Incas and the Mayas. But so there's that power imbalance, which always works in favor of the colonizer. And Alexander was not looking to lift up the population for their...
Yes, absolutely not. So it's the same colonizing force executed slightly differently on the linguistic plane.
Yeah.
Brianna, we've ended up talking about language as a window into seeing all sorts of different things about culture.
Well, I feel like the thing is that language is inherently powerful, and it inherently carries out power dynamics, whether that be the difference in accents, or, and therefore a bunch of code switching, or imperialism, meaning that people now have to speak another language.
Well, the code switching notion, you know, is an interesting one. Code switching, in my experience, just means using multiple language in the same utterance, for example. And it's looked down upon in educated spaces, in other words, but is quite common. In my own experience, for example, in Portugal, it did not happen until very recently. But in Montreal, for example, you walk into a shop now, you know how you are greeted. Bonjour, hi.
Mm-hmm.
Both.
Both. Now, for the defenders of the French language, this is a mortal insult, but it is daily practice in commerce. And that gives you, as the interlocutor of the salesperson, the option of saying, yeah, I'm looking for some socks, or je cherche des chaussettes, vous en avez dans ma taille. You can go either way.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, in Quebec, where there is the defense of the French language, which is often right in front of mind, that sort of flexibility is threatening. But you see code switching. In Montreal, most people are bilingual. And so they will routinely, if they can't think of a word in French, they will throw it in the English word. And then if you get into the arts, I did a lot of study of Francophone popular music, especially in Quebec, rap, for example. You can have people who will use an indigenous language, Arabic, Spanish, French, and English, not necessarily all in the same rap, but
potentially in the
potentially,
same. Potentially.
Yes. And often in multiples. And Creole, too, of course, because Creole is quite prevalent.
So you'd call it code switching when you're on the bus and you overhear somebody in a conversation in Arabic saying, okay, and...
And I think Christopher's very, very right to highlight that the more diverse or the more bilingual spaces, the more code switching can occur. And to Riona's opening point, it also doesn't have to happen between languages. It can happen within an individual language. So this gets into the dialects issue again, and also to cultural norms and socioeconomics, etc. But so, for example, in English, someone from South Texas, if I'm really like leaning into my roots, I might say, y'all fixing to eat yet? And in a academic setting, I would be very unlikely to say that same expression using those words in that cadence that quickly. I'd be more likely to say, are y'all about to eat? Or are you about to eat? Or are yins about to eat? And see, that's an additional code switch, because now I'm taking on the Pittsburgher cap and trying to utilize an indigenous term for y'all, the equivalent.
Well, that's the whole question of register, of course,
yes.
You know, so that code switching between registers. My experience being a jock, a musician, an academic, you know, and so you're talking to a bunch of hoopers,
mm-hmm.
There's going to be more profanity. You're going to be, the subjects that you discuss will be somewhat limited. Although I always defend intelligent jocks because they do exist.
And jock musicians apparently exist.
And jock musicians as well.
As well,
absolutely. So, but yeah, the registers, the social registers, which everybody knows,
yes.
Multiples, some maybe only two. They know that when they're talking to grandma,
right,
they're not supposed to swear.
Right. To your point, too, about the purpose of code switching, the purposes can vary. So Christopher's example is a utility-based code switch, saying bonjour, hi, so that your customer knows which language they can opt for, that there's aptitude in both, is utility-based. But you might be on the phone with with your grandmother and utilize a native or a heritage term to refer to her instead of saying grandma. Or you might say Mitchin, for example, which is Flemish, as a tone of endearment. And then that is a code switch that is used for emotive purpose. Or you might use it because you're multilingual and you can't find the damn word that you're looking for in the language you're speaking, so it comes to your mind in Greek or in Latin or in French or in Chinese or etc. But what's cool, what's so interesting is that in sociolinguistics, they've determined that, generally speaking, you code switch either to create distance from someone. So you use a word because the people around you won't know what you're saying. Or you do it for the opposite reason, which is to create a closer connection with someone because you know, okay, if I switch to Creole French and you know what I'm saying, I've just created a connection with you. I've just flagged that we have this commonality. And so code switching is this beautiful subtext of language to operate within language.
So we're here on Forbes Avenue talking with Marcy Persein, who's assistant professor in classics at the University of Pittsburgh, and Christopher Jones, who's emeritus professor of French and Francophone studies here at CMU. We've really been talking about language in the mind and translation, so I thought I would ask if you had opinions about language that doesn't really go through human minds, like the role of AI in translation.
Well, machine or computer-assisted translation as a practice didn't arrive with AI. And when I came here in 93, for example, it was well underway in computer science and so forth. And you could say anything like Google Translate, or, you know, there are multiples that are there which are not as powerful and don't use anywhere near as much fossil fuel to to make them work. I worked in intelligent tutoring systems here with people from computer science. And so the whole notion of creating a body of knowledge and modeling that body of knowledge and releasing stimuli to students based on that constructed body of knowledge, which the computer was keeping track of, which a teacher also does, of course, but that's not foreign to me. What's happening with AI is the artificial intelligence is able to learn on its own if it's fed. And of course, as a songwriter and a writer, the artificial intelligence needs to be fed existing texts, which were actually authored by humans, but which ends up causing an enhanced capacity in the artificial intelligence, which it then can turn around and do Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Not really, but, you know, maybe not Shakespeare, but can do Queen.
It
can do a pastiche of Shakespeare and fool a lot of people. Previously, the computer would spit out something and you'd say, okay, yeah, give me a couple hours and I'll put this into a final shape. Now with AI, it's instead of being 75% final, it's now 97% final to the extent that a professor might not know that the paper written for that assignment was not actually written by Bobby or Janie, but rather Robobby, you know, so to speak.
Robobby.
I just made that up.
I love that, though. I really appreciate your point, especially about how generative AI and language corpus tools are by nature of how they are constructed, machines designed for plagiarizing, right? They have to be fed something created by humans at some point in order to create something that is new, but all the parts are old. So in that sense, what ChatGPT or any of these AI tools do is they give you a quilt rather than a brand new fabric. And what humans can do with language is create a new fabric. That doesn't mean the quilt's not useful. And it doesn't mean that there's not, you know, potentially good purposes for AI too, although your point about the fossil fuels and the energy consumption is also very on the nose because it's deeply alarming. In learning languages, if you are not thrust into a space of immersion, the fear of failure is such an obstacle. You know, to walk into even like gabegie and order in French in Pittsburgh is very challenging and frightening. But to go on Duolingo and speak into a mic and have a bot respond to you in what feels like more or less canned French, a conversation you might drill and practice until you know it, that can overcome the fear of failure. So, you know, generative AI is kind of regenerative rather than generative, to your point, but there are definitely some uses to it that feel less destructive, but there's also no actual originality to it as it exists right now.
Well, that's a good point, though, that it can assist people in learning the language or getting you a rough translation that you can get a native speaker to help you sort it out so you haven't offended anybody in that language.
Absolutely. It's a good starting point or a good intermediary for sure. In the same way that Google Translate can be a very useful intermediary to start with. Mm-hmm. So, but you also might get some confused looks when you start speaking French in the form of Voltaire, because Voltaire is, of course, copyright free. There might be some lingering aspects of it in ChatGPT that, you know, just surface from time to time.
What about the global media? How's that affecting all the current languages?
Well, I also consume media. Just because my work is in the ancient world doesn't mean I'm dead. I do still, you know, watch, you know, Miyazaki films or K-dramas, or as you see globalization occur and more and more and more materials in their original languages available, Turkish dramas. Oh my God, amazing. It's easier to put yourself into spaces of immersion where, you know, you can turn on the subtitles, but eventually you might be doing the dishes while you're watching your Turkish drama and realizing that, oh, I actually don't need to read these English subtitles as much as I thought that I did, because I've been binge watching 5 seasons of historic romance that's all in Turkish.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to have the subtitles for those Hindi dramas I'm watching.
I guess you haven't watched enough.
That's right.
This is me empowering you to watch more.
Just watch more, Richard.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think back. I mean, remember, how old is the internet?
Mm.
And how old is the World Wide Web? Not that old. Older than you are. Okay. But just barely, right? I mean, you know, the fact is, we're not talking Roman Empire here. We're talking very recent history. And one of the main concerns outside of Anglo-Saxon spaces was that the World Wide Web and the internet were going to be English, you know, and it was going to be another example of cultural and linguistic imperialism. And now that has not turned out to be the case, although there's still probably a predominance of English interaction, right? Even in international, between spaces who don't actually speak English, and of course, speaking, learning a language via media, that's not an easy way to go, because it's never easy to do that, but it is certainly feasible.
You know, something that we've sort of been circling around, and I'd love to pick everyone's brain about, is the role of education in the way that we prioritize language. You know, there are languages that we predominantly use in classrooms, and there are languages that are predominantly spoken in households or in churches or in community centers or in, you know, gatherings that are all elders or all women. And these sort of different spaces activate different power dynamics. So one of the reasons why English has this almost chokehold on Americans' linguistic capacity is because English is taught as the de facto language in every public school in the country.
But of course, in North America, Quebec is the counterexample, where math and science and history and so forth are taught in French.
Yes.
And yet they're constantly battling against the wave of English.
I get the sense that even by the time my son, who's in his mid-30s, by the time he was in high school in America, languages were devalued, and people were only taking them because they had to take 2 years to have on their application to a four-year college.
Clearly, the value of language has shifted from my youth to today. Because the value of language, you could say, if I had actually been a Portuguese speaker, I could have gone right in, made myself a, I'm remembered for having integrated myself into Portuguese life. That was that massive effort with almost no preparation. Today, what would be the value of arriving with decent Portuguese? The Portuguese would speak to you in English. In France, I used to take students to a summer program. We'd arrive in Paris, and I'd say, hey, go get a coffee. We'll meet back here and take the train out to Strasbourg. They'd come back in tears because the waitress had insulted their French in French. Mm-hmm. Now that same waitress would have spoken to them in English. Mm-hmm. They would have had no opportunity even to be insulted, you know. So that is a huge difference. And you speak of educationally. Well, how do you get that immersion experience if you're coming from an Anglophone environment? If you're coming from University of Pittsburgh, you're coming from Carnegie Mellon, and you're going to a major European capital, people will speak to you in English mm-hmm. the moment they hear an accent.
I had a friend recently who studied abroad in France, and she didn't speak a lick of French while she was there. She said the only thing she had to be careful was in the line to the club. Mm-hmm. If she spoke English, she might get turned away. But if she had her friends without accents speak, then she could get in and continue living French-free.
I mean, to a certain extent, that's a classic story where the American kids go over and they all hang around in a cloud and just speak to each other and don't actually get any immersion experience whatsoever. But that was a lot harder to do even 20 years ago or so.
Although I do also wonder, I am just as prone to this as anyone else, so I promise I'm not pointing fingers, but with the rise of travel influencers on Instagram sending us to further and further obscure places off the beaten track, as it were, you know, I feel like it might be difficult to speak French in Paris, but it might be difficult not to speak French if you are outside of one of these major metropolitan spaces in France. And, you know, to circle back to the question of what the value of these languages are and learning second and third and fourth languages, you know, we could talk about, you know, the ways in which, say, you know, learning computer coding helps your brain develop different ways, new wrinkles, as I like to put it.
Or Christopher and I would say learning to play music develops
exactly,
different things.
Exactly. Or learning mathematics, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we all have calculators in our phones. Why do we need to learn basic multiplication rules? Well, it helps your brain develop, and it helps you hold different forms of critical thinking. And that's kind of getting on the higher tier of pedagogical reasoning for why languages are important. But there's also this fact that, you know, as much as the U.S. seems like a monolinguistic space, and as much as English is a lingua franca, there will always be people in the world you can't speak to unless you reach out and try to learn at least hello, bonjour, you know, ni hao, whatever language it is. And maybe that's your grandmother. Maybe that's your aunt. Maybe that's, you know, the person sitting next to you on the train who's reading a book that looks really interesting. Perhaps, you know, having these tools at our fingertips that can give us shorthands for translations can make, you know, those moments more approachable without the language learning. But I think the language learning is still important, so that you know how to use the tools, know what is the appropriate way to implement the tools. Yeah, it's such a good question.
This has just been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much, Marcy Person from Pitt and Christopher Mark Jones from CMU.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
That was an utter joy. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
India, in conjunction with Israel and the U.S., have been creating an ecosystem in which these countries invest in each other to such an extent that they become, if not sort of indistinguishable from each other, they are impossible to dislodge as oppressive systems. India is therefore invested in the occupation of Palestinians, Israel has become invested in the occupation of Kashmiris and the subjugation of Indian Muslims, and likewise.
That's Azad Issa, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Azad Issa on the India-Israel Alliance. Today, India and Israel have forged an alliance. It wasn't always that way. India became independent in 1947. Its first Prime Minister, Nehru, positioned his country as a champion of the Palestinian cause. As leader of the Non-Aligned Movement, India's stance on Palestine had great influence among other post-colonial nations. In the 1990s, that shifted. India moved into the U.S. orbit and embraced neoliberalism. And, at the same time, it moved closer to Israel. It was said if India wanted to be close to the United States, it had to reshape its critical policy towards Israel. And that they did. Today, the two countries have something in common. India's military occupation and domination of Kashmiris, and Israel's military occupation and domination of Palestinians. And India, under the Modi Hindutva Hindu nationalist regime, is the world's largest buyer of Israeli weapons. Israel, in return, buys weapons from India. Journalist and author Azad Issa says, Hindu nationalists have been observing how Israel has been behaving. More importantly, they're watching how the world is responding to it. They're noticing if you have America behind you, no one really can touch you. Our guest today is Azad Issa. He's an award-winning journalist and a senior reporter for Middle East Eye. His articles have appeared in The Guardian, Al Jazeera, and Foreign Policy. He's the author of Hostile Homelands, The New Alliance Between India and Israel. He gave the Hari Sharma Lecture at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, in May 2025. And now, Azad Issa.
We are definitely in perilous times. 100 wars of different types and in scale and of relevance to the international media continue to manifest around the world. Sudan, Palestine, Kashmir, Congo, Yemen, Chhattisgarh, all connected by imperialism and theft of resources, climate destruction and corporate greed, all cruel legacies of colonialism. In the case of India, the systematic degradation of basic institutions from civil society to the media and the judiciary has left an already embattled Indian democracy into little more than a skeletal outline of a dream. You would know, for instance, that Amnesty International was forced out of India in 2020 after facing harassment and intimidation from Modi's government. Likewise, you would be well aware too that several Indians with OCI cards have been refused entry into India owing to the critique of Modi. Perhaps some of you would also know that several Kashmiris over the past five years have been placed on travel bans, pulled off planes as they're about to depart Delhi, detained, and asked to sign bonds agreeing that they would cease to write negatively about India in order to be released. This is the Modi government, we are told. But how many of us would know that as far back as the 1970s, the Indian government was revoking and stripping Indian citizens of their passports? So I hope you will indulge me as I narrate these details, but I feel that it would be negligent to speak of the present, today, and the future without acknowledging the continuities with the past. And history is so omnipresent during these times. Palestinians commemorated Nakba Day, the catastrophe of death and ethnic cleansing that came with the creation of Israel in 1948. Black activists and anti-colonial scholars will mark the centenary of Malcolm X, who was born on May 19, 1925. His internationalism and deep meditation on questions of liberation, justice, and solidarity is a radiant reminder of our interconnectedness. The issues that concerned him too, like Palestine, Sudan, the Congo, continue to burn with injustice. His refusal to back down and his ability to see through respectability politics, or what Muhammad Al-Kurd would call the politics of appeal, as a means to appease liberal so-called dialogue, is foundational to recognizing and shoving the boot of our necks. And in the spirit of bluntness, it seems paramount to be blunt about our barely recognizable planet, you know, if we are ever to ever resurface. For this, we must talk about the Israeli genocide in Gaza as part of the larger economy of oppression and authoritarianism that does not merely carry the stamp of the West. In fact, the genocide in Gaza lies at the intersection of the building of a new world order in which the powerful are able to pursue expansion, domination, and the exertion of hard power over peoples, domestic or otherwise, with impunity. And the beating heart of this new pursuit is the burgeoning India and Israeli ties. This is not bluster, not hyperbole, but for this to make sense, we need to take a step back. When members of the Hari Sharma Foundation asked me to speak today about the relationship between India and Israel, the genocide in Gaza was in full flow, and the confrontation between India and Pakistan that threatened to escalate into war hadn't erupted. At the time, there was an uneasy calm between the two countries. Beneath the so-called calm, however, existed a story of Indian expansion in Kashmir, of the Indian state accumulating and implementing Israeli models in the most militarized region of the world, of the Indian state bringing tourists to Kashmir to depict a sense of normalcy. So the events in Pahalgam, in Indian-occupied Kashmir, on April 22nd, where armed men shot dead tourists, purportedly on the basis of the religion, tased the status quo out of the stupor of what it really was about, a delusion. As per usual, confusion reigned as an armed group claimed responsibility, then denied it, citing that their online presence had been compromised. And the Indian state and its stenographers, known as the Indian media, willingly distilled the ambiguity to gift India its pretext to wage war within minutes. But not just to wage war against it, against who it deemed to be guilty in this context, Pakistan, but to use the opportunity to reinforce several myths to consolidate and unify the nation. First, that this was an attack that resembled October 7th, the Hamas-led attacks on Israel in 2023. Second, that this was an unwarranted, brutal, and heinous attack on innocent tourists by a savage ideology. Third, that this incident deserved a fitting reply that suited India's newfound brawn in a new chaotic world order. For this too, the destruction of Gaza was invoked. Television channels spoke of carrying out a disproportionate response. They called for the army to bypass red lines to do so. The news media, along with Indian leaders, leaned into the Orientalist and war on terror lexicon of barbaric, dastardly, and savage to describe the incident in Pahalgam. There were news anchors like Arnab Goswami who called for, quote, a final solution for Pakistan. Hashtags we want revenge, hashtags destroy Pakistan popped up like digital billboards on the screen. Indian film stars too, who reside in parallel universes, marked their presence at Hindutva's digital headquarters by posting a jingoistic post or two. Obedience is a core principle in Modi's India, after all. Now, for a world horrified by genocide, live-streamed in Gaza, and largely familiar with Israeli propaganda over the past 18 months, the genocidal language from Indian channels was not difficult to discern. Even in a country where it's close to impossible to generalize one community, one idea, one narrative, there were very few who expressed public opposition to India's resort to unleash a punishment on Pakistan without it exhausting diplomatic efforts first, or without demonstrating proof to the world that Islamabad had actually orchestrated the incident in Pahalgam. It relied on an energy that the young would call trust me bro variety, and then for collective antipathy of the West towards a Muslim majority country. These calls for revenge came from across the spectrum, from the far right to the Communist Party of the Marxist variety. In a context of multiple conflicts around the world, deepening economic instability in India itself, where Modi's great economic wins haven't translated into job growth, the boisterous drum beats for war was not just vindictive, it was hysterical and dystopian. Whereas it was difficult just a decade ago to convince editors of international news media to cover ties between India and Israel, the symmetry today is so obvious it's being discussed and debated and torn apart in memes and TikTok videos. Hindu nationalists in India, many of whom endorsed Israel's action in Gaza as a legitimate war of defense, made no bones of calling for a so-called Gaza solution in Pakistan and Kashmir. This level of dehumanization of Palestinians in Gaza by Indians exerting their own fantasy of replicating the starvation of a people as they are bombed, left under rubble to suffocate, men, women, children alike, is a level of cruelty that can only be explained by mass delusion. It follows, too, the shameless support by Zionists for Israel's actions in Gaza. Gaza's destruction has been used as a cudgel, a flex by association with Israeli oppressors, is surely the mark of a sociopathic society in which cruelty has been normalized, empathy has been emptied out, and social values evaporated. And it's not only Hindu nationalists. At the other end of the spectrum, many liberals of the left persuasion, taken hostage by public pressure or driven by a deep set of jingoism that only Pakistan is able to trigger, trumped up support for the Jawans against what they seem to think was a legitimate war of attrition against the rogue neighbor. Terrorism for Pakistan had to be stopped, they argued. These attacks on Pakistan were getting out of hand, they chanted. Their nationalism was deemed so important, they were willing to suspend disbelief in the very state that had become the disinformation factory of the world because it involved Pakistan. They too didn't prioritize the need for proof or due process as per international conventions before endorsing striking its nuclear-armed neighbor. Both took their attacks on the Indian tourists in Pahalgam as an attack on the idea of India. Muddled with reports, the tourists were asked of their religious persuasion was enough to label it an attack on Hinduism itself. Now, even those Indians who would have not condemned the Hamas-led attacks on Israel on October 7th felt the need to immediately condemn the killing of tourists and call for swift revenge. They did so just as Israelis and many otherwise sensible Jewish Americans or Jewish American opponents of the Israeli occupation did after October 7th. And like their liberal and Zionist compatriots, few in India dared to ask obvious questions. The most glaring one being, are there a shortage of picnic spots in India? How is it normal for tourists to be picnicking in the world's most militarized zone known as Kashmir, where local Kashmiris live under de facto military law? Am I blaming the tourists? No. I am blaming India's occupation, which is at the root of all violence in Kashmir. Let me put it another way. Condemning the killing of tourists after they were picnicking in the world's most militarized zone and an occupied territory is to concede that their safety is more important than the people who actually live there. What is this except imperialism? But just as we've seen it done repeatedly, the chorus of condemnation took over and unified a country over the bellowing cry for vengeance. The Indian state saw it as a pretext to live out its Hindu nationalist fantasies. It leaned into the Hindutva's founding myths of being besieged and under threat from outsiders, of using the moment to reinforce a call to make India Hindu again, as they claim it was 1,000 years ago or thousands of years ago. To do this required bluster, to project oneself as masculine and militaristic, to project a new Hindu. Naturally, this involved unleashing terror against Muslims across the country. They had to be reminded, after all, that they were not part of the nation, that they had to be subservient to survive. And so what happened? The country unified behind the goal of providing punitive action. At the state level, the state canceled the Indus Water Treaty with Pakistan, threatening to cut the source of life to Pakistani farmers. On the local level, there were calls to boycott Muslims or Kashmiris. As one young Kashmiri girl doing her internship in Delhi told me, quote, the auntie who used to sell me food daily stopped doing so. She denied me roti, end quote. The Indian state too found it an appropriate time as ever to remind its neighbors they survived on borrowed time. It called the military escalation against Pakistan Operation Sindoor. The name cuts deep into the ideological makeup of the Indian state, where a Hindu nationalist agenda, which has for decades projected itself as militaristic and masculine and modeled on European fascist movements, seeks to mark Pakistan and Pakistan-administered Kashmir as its territory. This was an allusion to the RSS manifesto of reunifying all of so-called ancient India once more. It's not an assessment that has gone down well with India's liberals and the left, who say that this is not the policy of the Indian state. But India is already a country of vigilante-led lynchings, of aunties denying lunches, and the military operating loitering drones over madrasas in Pakistan. Are those the policies of the state? Why then is it so hard to believe that expansion is next in line? If both the right wing and secular nationalists believe that India is broader than its existing borders. And what is this India-Israel relationship that makes all of this even remotely possible or plausible? For this, we must consider the bedrock of the relationship, the unironic impulse to buy weapons to save democracy. India purchases more weapons from Israel than any other country and has done so for more than a decade. These arms are used by Israel and Palestinians. Then they find their way to Kashmir, to India itself, like Chhattisgarh. They also constitute a methodology of conducting operations within India. Let me provide one example. In February 2024, Indian farmer protests erupted in the state of Haryana, in which people who feed the people of India demanded guaranteed minimum prices for their yield. They were showered with lead-based pellets and as well as tear gas from loitering drones. It was thereupon discovered that the tactics used on the farmers were directly informed by the state government's visit to Israel in 2018 during the Great March of Return protests in Gaza. Back then, Palestinians were calling for their right to return to their homes outside the concentration camp called Gaza. Several delegates with the state's security apparatus, including the chief minister, said that they were looking to, quote, replicate Israel's tactics in Haryana. Now, here's his full quote. The idea behind the visit of the police delegation is to learn from Israeli experts how to improve the efficacy and efficiency of the law and order machinery to check crime and beef up security and intelligence network of the Haryana police, end quote. In other words, as Palestinians were being maimed by snipers, Indian leaders were studying how such ideas may be transplanted into Haryana. In this case, it took 6 years to activate. This is just one example. Like that, there are others in which the Indian states, like Maharashtra, have looked to implement methods of U.S. and Israeli homeland security among the police departments. So what about the political or diplomatic level? How do we see those ties playing out? In late 2019, following the revocation of Article 370, the Indian Consul General in New York called for India to build Israeli-like settlements in Kashmir for Hindus to essentially conduct demographic change. Quote from the Consul General, "We already have a model in the world. If the Israeli people can do it, so can we," end quote. Then there's the Citizenship Amendment Act in conjunction with the National Register, the NRC, that turns Muslims into second-class citizens and makes religion a basis of citizenship. This mirrors Israel's law of return that grants all Jews the right to immigrate to Israel and receive immediate citizenship. Then there's the extraordinary story of Delhi's support for Israel during this genocide, as countries have tried to force a ceasefire and an arms embargo onto Israel. New Delhi has supplied weapons, including combat drones and components for bombs. The weapons Israel once upon a time sold to India were now being co-produced in factories across India itself to support Israel. These include AI weapons. Then there's a remarkable request by Indian companies to India to have workers sent over to Israel to replace Palestinian workers post October 7th. Today, 12,000 Indian caregivers and construction workers have been sent to replace Palestinian laborers, now barred from working in Israel. Several Indian unions called on workers not to go to Israel, but Modi's jobless economic growth means that workers, abandoned by a system that favors predators, presents few options for those working for upward mobility. Perhaps the most telling sign of all of this is India's refusal to endorse the case of genocide at the International Court of Justice. But even as a fight continues on the international level, another fight is taking place on the cultural and educational domains. For instance, you may have heard of or even watched Fauda, the wildly popular TV series revolving around a team of trigger-happy commandos who love to kill Palestinians in the West Bank. In classic fashion, the show doesn't explain why Israelis feel so insecure, nor does it illuminate why the Palestinians might resort to violence, aside from explanations that revolve around personal vengeance and mummy and daddy issues. The Israeli commandos are known to, or shown to, break the law, all in the name of saving the nation, so much so that the audience is primed to support the crimes they must commit to save Israeli society. It is the TV series that effectively manufactures consent for war crimes. The show was so successful in India that filmmakers teamed up to produce Tanav, billed as an Indian remake of Fauda, set in Indian-occupied Kashmir. This is the level of consent for Israel being hardwired into Indian society. Take the rapid moves taking place among Indian universities over the past 18 months. As the biggest student movement since the anti-Vietnam War movement has engulfed universities across the U.S. and parts of other parts of North America, as well as Europe, over the growing anxiety over the future of collaboration with American universities, Indian universities have gone the other way. To assuage Israeli concerns about changes within their U.S. academy towards Israel, they have approached Indian universities for partnerships. So just as Palestinian workers' losses have been Indian workers' gain, the efforts of students to popularize the call for boycott and divestment at American universities has resulted in Indian universities' gain. During the course of this genocide, Indian universities have engaged or signed a mountain of deals with Israeli universities and weapons manufacturers. These partnerships, especially in the sciences, appear to focus not merely on building new hubs of defense and technology research for both the Indian and Israeli armed forces, but also as a means of exerting influence over Indian academia. But of course, these research ties aren't all about the military. They extend to more so-called innocuous fields like agriculture and water tech, which the Israelis use as a means to extend control and pacify through resource extraction and exploitation. Israel's USAID equivalent, I mean, the USAID doesn't exist anymore, but the equivalent, Mashav, is providing fellowships and short-term courses in Israel for Indians. Today, Indians make up the highest share of foreign students in Israel. So the attacks on Pakistan then have to be seen through the prism of an ethno-nationalist state that wants to paralyze dissent, subsume difference and diversity into a single stream of political ideological consciousness called Hindu nationalism. And to accomplish this project of mass pacification, India has turned to Israel for its expertise and for inspiration. And part of this effort has been the instrumentalization of the word democracy to achieve autocratic ends. Given what we know, that given that we know that the occupation of Kashmir didn't start with Modi, that the pogroms against Muslims and Sikhs didn't occur exclusively under the BJP-led governments, and that India was a Hindu-majoritarian country from the get-go, how did India get away with projecting itself as the antithesis of belligerence and as anti-colonial? For this, we can talk about Indian soft power that characterized Indianness, of family values, respect for elders, secularism, as traditional, hardworking, and educated. We can talk about Hindi popular cinema, cricket, yoga, Ayurveda, even Kama Sutra. In this way, Indian soft power is not so different from American soft power. American soft power, too, has sought to project the country as a nation that believed in certain values. It has perpetuated ideas about its beliefs and values. It has even feigned a certain self-reflection and notion of free speech to project its democratic exceptionalism. Now, India, having exerted soft power around the world, has shown an ambition to exert its newly acquired hard power as it sees fit. It wants to be taken seriously as a power, to be leader of the G20, to be on the United Nations Security Council as a permanent member. But how did India move from being a seemingly non-belligerent, non-violent land of Gandhi and the Lotus position to one which calls for flattening of its neighbor? Who helped project India to these lofty heights? And what does it have to do with India and Israel ties? Or with India's complicity in this genocide? Again, we need to go back, perhaps now, to partition and of Palestine and the subcontinent. I cannot surely get into all the fabrications of partition, the disinformation, the myths about India, many of which have been spread by Indian scholars or through Indian popular or American cinema, but it can allude to how we got here from an incident in 1947. In June 1947, Albert Einstein at the IAS in Princeton wrote to Nehru, the leader of the Indian National Congress, asking him, as the leader of the incoming Indian government, to support the formation of a Jewish state. In his letter to Nehru, Einstein writes, "May I tell you of the deep emotion with which I have read that the Indian Constituent Assembly has abolished untouchability. I read that the curse of the pariah was about to be lifted from millions of Hindus in the very days when the attention of the world was fixed on the problem of another group of human beings who, like the untouchables, have been victims of persecution and discrimination for centuries." He continues, "I find profoundly gratifying the fact that the reconstruction of Palestine has taken not through the exploitation of native workers, the usual pattern of imperialism, but through the heroic toil of Jewish pioneers. The once malaria-ridden swamps, the stony mountain slopes, the salt shores of the Dead Sea, now fertile and blooming, are evidence of a creative impulse whose thwarting would make mankind, as well as Jew and Arab, the poorer," Einstein wrote. In his reply to Einstein, Nehru refuses to take a firm position. He declines the invitation to be a patron of the new Jewish state. He says that he's not competent to pass a final opinion as to what should be done. But his overall answer is quite illuminating. "I have paid a good deal of attention to this problem of Palestine. I have read books and pamphlets on the subject issued on either side. Yet I cannot say that I know all about it or that I am competent to pass a final opinion as to what should be done. I know the Jews have done a wonderful piece of work in Palestine and have raised the standards of the people there. But one question troubles me. After all these achievements, why have they failed to gain the goodwill of the Arabs? Why do they want to compel the Arabs to submit against their will? The way of approach has been one which does not lead to a settlement, but rather to the continuation of the conflict. I have no doubt that the fault is not confined to one party." He finishes. Now, what is particularly fascinating about this exchange, and there are many, is the level of myth-making on both sides. You have Einstein talking about the end of caste. As you know, that's false. It was false in 47, it's false today. Hindu nationalists today have themselves tried to co-opt caste into the project. Likewise, Einstein repeats myths that the Zionists built up the land, showing how ubiquitous this perception was in Zionist circles. This too is a myth that continues to circulate today. On the part of Nehru, as you may note, he says both sides have erred. And he goes on to recognize that Zionists have helped build up Palestine. Now, this is the great anti-colonialist, as many remember him, meekly saying that he does not know how the colonial project in Palestine may be resolved. It is this exchange that sets up the symbolic parameters of the relationship between India and Israel in the decades to come. Yes, Einstein changed his mind about Israel, of which much has been written. But did anyone correct him on the question of caste or of his impression of the moral compass of the Indian state coming into being? The exchange, too, showcases the level of myth-making at the heart of America's institutions. Einstein, sitting at Princeton, invokes India's purported success of eliminating caste as a means to draw India closer to the Zionist project. Likewise, Nehru, like many leftists and liberals in India, would appear to do later on, accepts this praise despite knowing that caste has never been abolished and that India itself was violently put together, including occupying Kashmir, and lets the perception settle that India was an exceptional state with a moral backbone that held it back from becoming closer to Israel. But New Delhi, like other states, designed its foreign policy based on self-interest. There was a certain currency with the so-called Third World to be seen as pro-Palestine. It didn't have the military to compete with the world powers, so it instead became a critic of it. It bided its time. Nehru and co. allowed an incomplete narrative of Indian descent and objection to the Zionist project to grow and to thrive. It inadvertently helped bury the question of the Indian caste system in the West and elsewhere. In other words, and as you would know, for decades, India has been largely and uncritically so seen as a left-leaning anti-colonial state that held Palestine as its moral center, despite its occupation of Kashmir and its violent policies towards Muslims and Dalits and Adivasis. These issues, many liberals and leftists say, only propped up recently with the rise of Hindu nationalism. But India bought weapons from Israel as early as 1962 in its war against China under Nehru. Again in 65 and in 71 against Pakistan, it imported weapons from Israel. And as Indira Gandhi publicly endorsed the PLO and signed on to Resolution 3379 at the UN that called Zionism racism, her office was privately facilitating Mossad and raw ties. And this continues through the 80s, when the prospect of Israeli ties is increasingly tied with modernization, development, and being closer to the US. India's charge towards neoliberalism is inextricably linked with the great charge towards Hindu nationalism. This encompasses a focus on Hindu entrepreneurship and innovation and self-reliance at the cost of Muslims and as part of a politics of reinforcing a Hindu history on the story of India. And that takes off here. Here it is India's Prime Minister, Rajiv Gandhi, who is explicitly told by American or Zionist American groups that if India wants to be close to the US, it has to reshape its policy towards Israel.
You're listening to Azad Issa, the India-Israel Alliance. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
In other words, the entanglements of Hindu nationalism and its delusions of grandeur and illusions of being a besieged people that we are seeing today in the expressions of both the support of Israel and the duplication of Zionist lies, barely fathomable deception is both the project of the so-called left and the right in India, and that extends decades. Today is no aberration. This is not coincidence. This is India. And to borrow from Edward Said's analogy about Israel and Zionism, this is India despite Hindu nationalism's impulse to conceal it. So where does it leave us? Where do we go from here? If the India-Israel alliance is not stopped, we are looking at India becoming the factory